Talk given Friday, 24th October, 1975.
First, let us bear in mind that religion, in its living sense, is concerned, amongst other things, with bringing religiousness, which characterizes us as human beings, to fruition. And the bringing to fruition is necessarily a living process. It's a process of growth, of maturing. In this process of growth and maturing, one of the outstanding things that happens to us is that we discard our mental fixations, our rigid ideas, our fixed ideas. We discard them not so much after the fashion of throwing an object into the dustbin because it is no longer required, but it falls off us, so to say, like a scab which in due time just falls off because the new skin, the new healthy skin, has grown. So the old scab just falls off. And this involves, therefore, freedom from conflict. You don't have to struggle to get rid of something. It just naturally falls off because one has grown within oneself. This is something very, very different from what people usually try to do. Usually people preconceive something, or they form a concept, a fixed concept, their own mental construct, in accordance with what they have read or what they have heard or been told by somebody. All that is out, because that isn't a living thing. That is a mechanical process, just a machine-like putting together of ideas. When one is alive and awake within oneself, the mind naturally produces ideas, but does not hold them rigidly, doesn't want to keep hold of them, because the living mind is constantly throwing out ideas, and it just lets them go. It's the mind which is getting dulled, which is getting burdened, which wants to cling to ideas, to concepts. Consider, if the body, for instance, in its living process, were to stay put in a particular condition, the living process would cease, wouldn't it? That would be the end of the living process, because the living process inevitably means change, constant change. We take in food and drink and breathe air, and all that undergoes change, produces change in the living body. The cells are renewed, and therefore the body lives. But if that process were to stop, we would say, I like this body as it is, now let it stay put. We'd immediately become a block. don't we? But we fail to see this and to appreciate its importance in connection with the mind. So we have fixed ideas. And by having fixed ideas with respect to the mind, therefore also with respect to ourselves, we get stuck. We don't grow. Worse than that, we are in a state of conflict inwardly. The life energy wants us to move on, and we, this part of us which wants to stay put, tries to oppose that life energy. This is one of the main reasons why we cannot be open-minded, truly open-minded, or truly healthy-minded. This is not to support the idea that fortuitous change is to be welcomed. Not fortuitous change, but change which represents real growth, a living process. An idea, a belief, may be so much alive in itself, so near the living reality, that it may have a longish life. That is very different from its being a fixation. You will notice that where ideas have a long life, they are undergoing change, improvement. They are becoming more perfect, more lightened up. And they are a source of strength, therefore, to the mind. But the time comes when the transformation of the idea has proceeded so far that it bears little relationship to the original shape it had when it started. It is the shape, the form, which we cling to. And that is what stops us from growing. The long and the short of it is that we never really know ourselves. And one of the ways in which this operates is of special interest to us. We have our own concept of what knowing means. But is that real knowing? What does the world as a whole understand by the word knowing? The acquisition of conceptual and verbal patterns. I know this, I know the other. All that has happened is that because these patterns are presented in the language which I do happen to speak, therefore, when I hear these sounds, the words, or read the words, there is immediately a picture in my brain about it, and I say, I know this. But do I? The doctor says, if you keep on drinking so much whiskey every day, or whatever it is, you will get cirrhosis of the liver. Oh yes, I say, I know that if I drink so much whiskey, I will get cirrhosis of the liver. I continue to drink an extra bottle a day. Now, do I really know the truth of what the doctor told me? If there is real knowing, is it opposed to, divorced from, action? The appropriate action which expresses the truth of that knowing. We can appreciate why Plato said that no one knows anything unless he can do it, and do it spontaneously, naturally, without any struggle. Then he really knows. If I want to play something on the piano, and I just sort of try to strum through the notes which I see in front of me on the sheet of paper, I'll produce some sort of sound. But do I really know the music that way? But when I can play it beautifully, perfectly, and every time I play it, it is a creation. It conveys a new message. Then surely that is knowing that piece, isn't it? So, our concept of knowing also undergoes a change. We get rid of the concept gradually. The concept gets transformed. And what happens is that we grow in our inner awareness as to the true nature of the thing. Now, growing in one's inner awareness is quite different from holding so many thoughts or ideas. One has to just let the mind be quiet and feel this out. Don't let the feeling be directed by thought, because thought will inevitably imprison, constrict feeling. This feeling has no relationship with the meanings of words like sensation or emotion. This is quite a different feeling. This is the living activity of the mind, the living aspect of it. The warm energy which flows out of the mind. It is not the cold intellectual container producing aspect. It is the living contained energy, this feeling part. Now, if we apply this to our knowledge of ourselves, what we call the knowledge of ourselves, we will find that all the ordinary concepts we held are very inadequate and misleading. So we inevitably make mistakes in our daily life, both with respect to ourselves and to our environment, which includes other selves. This awakening in one's inner awareness, the awakening in inner awareness, is one of the hallmarks of realizing our true human nature. Not the acquisition of thoughts, ideas, and so forth. That is all part of the story, and it's a very unimportant part relatively to this inner awakening of awareness. It is not as if we go through a process of mental titivation to prepare ourselves for the party or the occasion. It's not that. This inner awakening is the most real living insofar as human beings are concerned. Insofar as other creatures are concerned, animals, any other creatures are concerned, it would probably be something quite different. But for us, this awakening of our inner awareness is the important thing. And as I said, we will find that the whole ragbag full of ideas undergoes considerable change, and a great many of them are, one just empties oneself of those ideas. The ideas, insofar as they are a weight upon us, repress our whole being. We are not free. We are not at ease. Who can say that he is completely at home in the world? And the world, first and foremost, means his own living organism. He doesn't even know his own living organism. He's only vaguely conscious of it. He can't feel his livingness. If he did, his breathing would always be rhythmic and peaceful. But catch yourself throughout the day. Note how the breath rhythm varies. Consider, for example, by contrast, the rhythm of the earth as it rotates on its axis and revolves around the sun. It's an undisturbed rhythm. It is a free movement in space. The earth does not and cannot fall as we could fall, in our sense of the term. If our own organism lived perfectly rhythmically and was fully awake from within, it's interesting to wonder whether it would ever fall. Whether it was walking or running or jumping or anything. Why should it fall? Now, with this inner awakening of awareness, we find that our conceptual frontiers to ourselves, which we have made for ourselves, begin to break down. They begin to fall away. It is perfectly true that the physical body itself is delimited by the skin, the surface of the body, and if by any chance a body finds that it's becoming too much, it grows too much in this direction, it does
a good many things to bring it back to what it would consider normal.
But apart from the fact that the body has its limits as such, this thing which we call self-consciousness, self-awareness, what are its limits? Has it any limits? And even physically, you have heard me say this before, but bear with it once again. Even physically, we breathe in, we take air into ourselves from outside, and we take for granted that that air is part of us, the body, as far as the body goes. But when I breathe out, has a bit of me, this become me? See, one can see that physically that's a very simple example. But take the whole idea, take the question of thought and feeling. We say my thoughts, my feelings, my ideas, my beliefs, my concepts. To what extent am I talking truthfully, accurately, I mean? I'm not deliberately lying, I'm only making a statement perhaps out of ignorance, an inaccurate statement out of ignorance. How much is it my thought? If everybody around me is feeling in a certain manner, and I catch that feeling, I'm influenced by it. Can I say that that is my feeling? Or has a great wave of feeling just permeated me too? Like, there is a fog a mile away from here. Everybody who walks into the fog or is driving or riding a bus through it is in the fog. But which part of the fog is his? He is part of that whole atmosphere. My feelings, my thoughts, similarly, have no proprietary meaning whatsoever. See, I don't want you to just take this as such. It all sounds perhaps a bit trivial and perhaps a bit vague. The vagueness doesn't matter at all. But if you were to let the mind be quiet and enter into it and awaken from within, you will discover an extraordinary release from the constriction imposed upon us by definite thoughts, by very clear-cut ideas. Now you know that I am not at all one who is against clear-cut ideas. To be clear-sighted is essential. You know that I like everything to be lucid. And if a person speaks, let him speak quite lucidly. All right. So that I don't suppose I can be accused of holding a brief against lucidity or clarity of the mind. But what I am trying to suggest is that lucidity and clarity of mind is not to be confused with fixed ideas. Fixed ideas, strict definitions,
all have a very distinct outline, but their inside is opaque. They don't let the light of knowledge, the light of understanding, get through. This is the difficulty. The ideas begin to, the ideas, beliefs, concepts, convictions, all of them begin to concretize to such an extent that light can't get through. Then you're stuck. This is where the mind is quite different from the body. The body has to be solid.
Now, I want to put some ideas before you. Let us see that any particular finite being or object may be regarded as a congeries of energies. What is the body? We say, oh, it's matter. What is matter? Today, the materiality of matter doesn't worry us anymore. We know through modern science, we know of the interconvertibility of matter and energy. Matter is concretized energy. Concretized to such an extent that we, as living bodies, if we come across matter in the solid state, we'll experience resistance. It would give our bodies a sensation of hurt if the contact happened to be violent, and so on and so on. We know all this from our ordinary experience. This is concretized energy. But then, matter in the gaseous state is in so much less a concretized state of the same thing which we call energy that it would not hurt us. Sometimes it does if we have tornadoes and such things. They can really hurt us. But the extent of that concreteness disappears altogether as far as our experiencing it in terms of our living bodies is concerned, when we come to the realm of energy as energy. Now, the important thing to bear in mind is that we do not know energy in its absoluteness. We only know it at best in its secondary stages as electrical energy, heat, light, mechanical energy, and so on and so on. But we know this, these secondary stages, only because there is a very concrete, a highly concrete apparatus
through which certain phenomena are manifest to our senses.
Do try and follow this carefully, because it has a tremendous consequence. So these secondary stages through which energy manifests are completely interdependent with the concretest form of energy, matter. Electrical energy, all right, you have a wire and this, that and the other, and chemicals and so on, all at work. Heat energy, in the same way, you have physical matter associated with it, concrete matter associated with it. But if we ask, what is energy in itself? We are completely ignorant. We don't know. Now link this up with what we tried to understand about knowing, our concept of knowing. We think we know, and we say, oh, I know this and I know that. Now you see how unreliable, how tenuous, how unsubstantial is our knowing. We don't really know. Now, if we truly see this, not merely because we deduce it logically, intellectually, but we really see this, we have awakened from within, in our inner awareness, so completely that suddenly, and it always happens suddenly in a situation like this, suddenly we know, of course I don't know. Now in that state of I don't know, as far as the conceptualizing, the idealizing, the idealizing mind is concerned, then one is becoming aware in the real sense, or at least in a much more real sense than what we do in our ordinary everyday life and everyday manner. There is a sense there is a real understanding, not with the brain merely, it is felt, it's a feeling which absolutely pervades us. There is the feeling that the finite has become the infinite, is the infinite, that the measurable is the immeasurable. And if that is the case, then we see the tremendous importance of being in the harmless state. Because if the finite is so completely involved, so totally interrelated with the infinite, the measurable with the immeasurable, if I, as a finite creature, were to hurt another finite creature, then I have denied the truth of what I commonly call his being or my being. I should say not or, but and, my being. In hurting you, I've hurt myself. In hurting myself or letting myself get hurt through my ignorance and foolishness and the pursuit of my passions and desires and so forth, I'm also hurting you.
You see, the basic moralities which the great teachers taught
are the result of an extraordinary enlightenment from within. They are not merely emphasized social rules. You mustn't hit your neighbor. You may, if he does you wrong, you must appeal to the law. It's not just that. Now, this congery of energies, which is the living person or any particular object. This congery of energies. The one energy manifesting as a combination of various aspects. For instance, in the living body, heat is manifest, electrical processes are manifest, and so on. All right? It's a congery of energies. Now, I said heat, electrical processes and so forth. But does that exhaust all the energies?
Surely, far from it. There must be so many forms of energy of which I, as an ordinary human being, am quite ignorant.
But if I have seen this much, then my mind is open to become aware of what is more than what I already see. And if the mind is open, if it is pliant, if it is poised, quiet within itself, then there can be real growth, which is religious growth. Because the religiousness in one's nature is perhaps the strongest power to put one in harmonious relationship with totality. This is religiousness. Quite practical, quite simple. I could almost say, yeah, I will say it, quite matter of fact. It's the perfection of secularity. The perfection of secularity completely meets with and melts into, so to say. The two get welded into one. The perfection of secularity is also the perfection of the sacred.
When a great artist, a truly great artist, creates something wonderful in his own art, the actual manifestation in terms of art is a thing, a manifested thing, secular. But transcendence itself, functioning freely through that creative artist, enabled that artist to be the medium through which this perfection came into being.
Where is the quarrel between religion and the religious and the secular? None at all. So let us get back to this feeling of oneself being a congeries of energies. You know how practically all human beings, especially in our so-called developed countries and in our modern world where we have achieved this horrible conquest of nature, as we call it, and this mastery over the powers of nature, without having anything like true humanity developed in us. And because of that, the first thing we do with any new power that we learn to control is to use it for destruction, for hurting somebody. The chap who invented the bow and the arrow, what did he do with it? He killed something with it, first and foremost. He didn't use it for just bringing down a conker from the chestnut tree. Used it to kill his enemy, as he called him, or the animal that he wanted to eat, satisfy his hunger. Now, a congeries of energies, and energies interplay in an extraordinary manner. Positive, negative. If there is the play of positive, negative forces of any and every sort, then manifestation is there. Growth, progress, development, construction, also destruction. The breaking up of old forms, of old relationships, and so on, all that is also there. Now, each person within himself, as a congeries of energies, is a combination of all these positive and negative forces, these male and female forces. You all know that wonderful phrase, the marriage made in heaven. And how do we construe that phrase? What sort of a conception? It would be truer to say, what sort of a misconception do we form in relation to it? The marriage made in heaven. Let us start from where we are. As we are, ourselves, in our own being, we talk of body and psyche. We talk of male body and the anima. We talk of a female body and the animus. The positive-negative aspects. But in every bit of ourselves, actually, there is the play of positive-negative forces, male-female forces. And the simplest and the first meaning of the marriage made in heaven is the harmonizing of the positive and negative forces in our own psychophysical structure. Our own positive, negative activities. Take the body itself, by itself, whether it be a male body or a female body. There is work and there is rest. There is effort, energy put forward, and then there must be relaxation, and so forth. This harmony, this balance, this is one of the deep meanings of upekkha, the Buddhist upekkha. This equanimity, this poise, is not a static thing. The living process has to be an equable process. Now this applies even more so to the psyche. The positive and negative aspects in us, the male-female aspects in us. It is those which get disarranged and it is those which are in conflict inside ourselves all the time. There is no marriage between them, no action in union, in unity, in harmony between the positive and negative aspects of the psyche, the male-female aspects of the psyche. And as and when the psyche as a whole, male-female as it is in itself, is in harmony with the body, then the simplest and the first meaning of the marriage made in heaven is realized. Then one has begun to be self-contained. Self-contained meaning that one is psychophysically poised, continuously in that state. There is a profounder step one can take. You know how in Genesis the Lord God, Yahweh Elohim, made the woman, Esha, and brought her unto Adam. After he had caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam. Yahweh Elohim represents the slumbering, subtle energies within the living psychophysical organism. Yahweh is the immanence within oneself. Elohim is the process by which the container of this immanence allows that immanence to come to fruition. So Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God, is part and parcel of this thing we call oneself. Brought the woman, Esha. Her name means the daughter of Esh, the creative cosmic fire. They use the term fire. Today, if we felt and thought in those terms and produced theologies or whatever it is, we would perhaps say electricity rather than fire. But the words don't matter. You see, that's why I talk such a lot about words and ideas and so forth, and don't get caught up in them. You see, all right. What does that mean?
Adam in a state of sleep. But was he in a state of sleep? Or was he in that state of peace,
that quiescence which is not mere static inactivity, but that state of inward harmony, such harmony of the psychophysical organism that it looks as if the person is entirely asleep, but actually is completely open to reality, to truth. And so this mysterious, unknown energy, this transcendent energy represented by the terms Yahweh Elohim, brought forth Esha, the daughter of the creative power itself throughout the universe, this creative energy. And what happened? The Lord God never laid down an injunction, as all the translations tell us, thou shalt not eat of the fruit of this tree. What he did was, don't ask me how I know, I don't know. That is why I'm telling you. You see, what he did was to say something like this: if you eat of the fruit of this tree, then you might be subject to death. But what did the Lord God mean by death? Not what ordinary mortals mean. The transformation, the transmutation, which is so tremendous, so complete, that you can't recognize the old after that. It's finished, completely gone. And what was this fruit? This fruit, which did not grow upon the tree of good and evil at all. It was on the tree of life itself. Because remember, Genesis says that both these trees were in the middle of the garden. You can't have two trees in the middle. You can have them side by side, but both can't be exactly in the middle. This was the tree of life. And when Esha, this daughter of the creative power, the female, the negative, is the active thing, the thing which works and produces results. It's the electrons which are the important thing, not the jolly old positive protons. They just do nothing, they stay at home, like grand seniors. You see? All right, so Esha is that driving power towards the supreme fruition of our own religiousness, which makes us wholly human. Wholly human. And remember, human means the happy creator. Now, Adam does not pluck the fruit. The fruit is plucked by Hava. By Esha, not by Hava. Hava comes later on. Eve. Plucked by Esha. And she gives it to Adam. The Lord God laid no injunction upon Esha about plucking or not plucking. This is the point which everybody forgets. She plucked it. ate of it and gave it to Adam. Adam, being not sufficiently developed, couldn't utilize it to the full. This fruit is consciousness. That is the fruit. Awakened consciousness. He awoke partially, and he awoke just that much partially as to get caught up in duality and the conflict of duality. He didn't wake up wholly. So he got caught in the either or. This is pleasing, this is painful. I like the pleasing, I will go for it, and reject the painful. I can't reject any part of the cosmos at any time. It's totally impossible. So this meant that which is represented by the term the fall of Adam. And the redemption means that the sinless state has to come into being. That is to say, the state which does not divide things up. That's the first meaning of the word sin. The attempt to sunder the unity of the universe. And what is it that sunders the unity of the universe? Our sense functioning, and it is not our sense functioning that does it, but the thought process, the intellect, which synthesizes the sense impressions. The intellect is unable to integrate the sense impressions. This is the difficulty. The brain synthesizes them. But if the inner awareness is awakened, then Esha is once again fully functioning. And the total being is in the enlightened state. The state which is pure wisdom and pure love. This love in this context, don't look in the dictionary for its meanings. This is something utterly different. Love in this context simply means that your whole creative being is functioning in terms of unity with the totality. And that is love. Action, in the purest sense of the word. So this thing which we call ourself is a congeries of such energies. And where does one draw the line to demarcate the extent of the energy?
Oh no,
it's universal. So that the one true meaning of the word I, or the word you, or he, or she, which are all distinctive terms, sundering terms, the one true meaning is the totality itself, is transcendence itself. Now, as I say, you've heard lots of words from me. Concepts get formed. All right, that is inevitable. We are what we are. There is no escaping that fact. And when one person speaks, the other person can only get and raise up in his own mind concepts. True. But having done so, let the mind be quiet. Don't play with the concepts and try and make sense or find deeper meanings or this, that and the other, because you'll produce new concepts. Don't treat concepts like a dog will treat so many bones. Just let the concepts lie, like sleeping dogs, let them lie. Just let them lie, let them be quiet. And you will find extraordinary things happening. This living process, Esha at work, will enable the Adam in us, whether we are male or female, we are all Adam, we are all Esha also. You see? Let that work. And this wonderful thing called man will come to fruition within your own being.